May it please the board, David Goodham for the United States.
You're going to have to pull the microphone closer to you, I think, so I can hear you.
David Goodham for the United States, Your Honor. In the context of a government motion, Rule 35, substantial assistance motion, the court in this case reduced the defendant's original sentence of 96 months to a single day. The court premised that reduction on its belief that the Bureau of Prisons would not be able to maintain the defendant on the medication that he had been prescribed and was currently using for his attention deficit disorder. In premising the reduction in a 35B context on that reasoning, the court erred. And in that regard, the sentence was imposed in violation of law pursuant to 18 U.S.C. 3742. A Rule 35B proceeding is not a plenary resentencing. It's not a redo. You can't go back at the sentence from the ground up. And that's clear from analysis of the text of the rule and the overarching sentencing structure and, I would suggest, from policy. Focusing first on the text, it's telling that the only justification noted in the rule itself for a reduction is substantial assistance. Further, if you look at the title of the rule, it says...
But isn't it true a prior iteration of the rule was more expressly specific?
There was, I believe there was an amendment in 2002 that said to reflect substantial assistance, and in 2002 the committee excised the phrase to reflect. In doing so, the committee also noted this was a stylistic change.
I know they said that, but and I think maybe you are right on that factually. Do you think it'd be even a more clear-cut case if it said to reflect?
I certainly think it would take it out of the realm of even reasonable minds disagreeing, certainly. But considered in context with 18 U.S.C. Section 3553E, which actually still does have the to reflect language, and that's the pre-sentence analog to 35B.
I interrupted you, but I take you're going to stay, and then the advisory committee note for the advisory commentary is that stylistic changes only.
Yeah.
And then you're going to say something about the title of the section.
I was just going to point out that when you look at the hints from the rule itself and its context, the title is another indication that this is not a plenary resentencing. The title says for substantial assistance, reduction for substantial assistance. I think further evidence that this is not a resentencing hearing and that 3553A factors can't come into play when you're just when you're talking about augmenting the reduction. If you go to the provision that allows a court to consider pre-sentencing assistance, when you look at that provision, that is a methodology for calculating substantial assistance. It's telling that that methodology only, again, refers to assistance. It doesn't refer to any other factors.
Well, so let me ask you this. If you came in to court making a Rule 35B motion and in between the time of the original conviction and the motion, the Senate committed another crime, would you tell the judge to factor that in to the decision as to how much to how much credit to give for the assistance?
Your Honor, this court's cases and the other circuits' cases indicate that a court can take into consideration 3553A factors when considering whether to depart and the scope of the departure. What the court cannot do is augment the departure beyond the substantial assistance measure.
So you give less but not more.
That's right.
Good, you can consider bad factors that are bad for the defendant, but you can't consider factors that are good for the defendant.
In that regard, the rule operates as a one-way ratchet. In some cases, the courts have looked at that and said, well, that seems odd, but when you step back and assess that one-way ratchet, it actually makes a lot of sense. The court always has a duty to announce a just and reasonable sentence. In the context of a Rule 35 motion, the reduction, this is the first time the court is assessing that requested reduction. This is the first time the court is considering the scope of the reduction. In that regard, the court, when deciding whether the sentence will be just as a part of the reduction, can consider the 3553A factors.
But there are factors that are unrelated to the assistance.
They can be when the court is assessing the discretionary decision whether to grant the departure.
Right.
But once the court makes an assessment of, okay, this is how much the substantial assistance is worth, the court then can't augment that reduction on the basis of extra consideration of other 3553A factors.
Now, can you give me any help in understanding that rationale why factors that are unrelated to the assistance can be used to cut back on the amount of departure, but they can't be used to increase?
I think the best example, this is not an original thought. It comes from the Seventh Circuit's decision in United States versus Shelby. In that case, Judge Posner posited this hypothetical that I think answers this question. If the government came into court and we were talking about a mass murder, many homicides, he'd only served a year in jail, and the government, for whatever reason, came into court with the defendant and said, Your Honor, the assistance this defendant has provided us is fabulous. You should reduce his sentence to time served. In that context, the court has a duty, an overarching duty, to still provide a just sentence. And so in that context, as Judge Posner pointed out in United States versus Shelby, it would be perfectly appropriate for the court to take into consideration, for example, the circumstances of the offense.
But that's right, but those factors are related to the assistance.
Possibly, but I think you could even posit examples where they wouldn't be related to the assistance. And it would still be appropriate when a court is answering that first question, do I give a departure or not? The court still could take that into consideration. It's only when you get to the point where, okay, I'm asking the question now, I've adjudged the measure of the substantial assistance. Now I'm going to give an extra reduction, if you will. For example, in this case, the judge beckoned to the fact that the Bureau of Prisons wasn't going to necessarily keep him on his prescribed medication. And in that context, it's inappropriate. And again, that makes sense when you consider about it. If you look at the Supreme Court's decision in United States versus Dillon, that was in the 3582C context, but I think the analysis is apt here. These are very limited, narrow circumstances by which Congress has said a judge can reduce a sentence. They are a function of congressional lenity. They are only reductions, and it is not a chance for the court to go back and reconsider things relating to the original sentence. And Dillon was quite clear about that in the context of 3582C2, the retroactive guidelines scenario. And the court said these are not resentencings. These are not plenary proceedings.
What if the court was thinking about health and just said, "This, in my estimation, this is tremendous under the circumstances. This is tremendous substantial assistance." Called it that, and then granted relief down to 1 day.
If the court had not articulated an illegal factor,
yes,
that would be a very difficult decision for the government to appeal, I would suggest. We do have here the overt reference to...
No, I know what you have in this case. I was just asking to explore the parameters of it.
The judge is assumed to know and follow the law. In that case, I don't think the government could come up on appeal and suggest that the court did not know and follow the law. And this court's jurisprudence with respect to Rule 35 is very circumscribed in what can be appealed and what can't. And it has to fit into that narrow category of 3742A, a violation of the law.
You can appeal the extent of the departure.
I think that's right.
You can only appeal if there's a violation of the law.
That's right, Your Honor. And so in that context, if we were on a different record, it would be a difficult argument for the government to make on appeal.
If we were to agree with you, what would happen on remand with respect to substantial assistance?
If this court agreed and indicated that Poland and Shelby and all the other cases got it right, then the district court now would have an understanding of what the law was and what the parameters were. And again, we assume judges know and follow the law. And in that context, this judge would have been told that you can't beckon to the medication regimen of the Bureau of Prisons to make a decision about the extent of his reduction. And we would assume the judge would know and follow the law. And
would the government still have the ability to support or oppose reduction or potential?
To the extent that we've gone on record and we've filed a motion, we think this man provided substantial assistance. I don't think there's going to be any doubt that we will go back to the court and make the same point. It's just a function of...
The motion would have been made because you can't get there unless you make the motion. The motion's
right.
Made, and you might well recommend to the court what you think the court should do, what would be appropriate, but then the court, knowing the law, follow the law, would just have to take into account what you say, take into account what the defendant may say, and just come up with some sentence that appropriately rewards that level of assistance. We just go back for resentencing on that issue.
That's exactly.
And you just think that would be more cabined as to what would be appropriately considered by the jury.
That's right. I think this is just a function of we're at the point where the Supreme Court has said these reductions, these modifications of sentences are narrowly circumscribed. I won't belabor this point. I'll make my final point here unless the court has any other questions. I think the Seventh Circuit, again, in the United States versus Shelby, has this exactly right. You have to ask a question about the policy behind Rule 35.
Well, let me stop and ask you this question. I'm just wondering, and I don't take this to be specific to this judge at this point. Is this one of the kind of cases where the departure motion should be considered by another judge? I'm not asking your comment on this specific judge now, but I'm just saying in light of the fact that once the decision to depart is made, we really don't know other than the articulation as to why the motion was done. We basically accept it. Is this the kind of case where we would send it back to another judge?
We haven't asked for that, Your Honor.
I know you have.
I don't think that's necessary here. This judge, there's no reason to believe this judge wasn't acting under a misunderstanding about the scope of her jurisdiction under Rule 35.
I was just asking not about this case specifically, but a general group of cases in which if it is appealable and the court were to decide in my hypothetical case, clearly a factor outside what is allowed was considered and articulated. And then with the idea of a thought that it's just articulation that matters, it's not the motivation really, it's the articulation. If that would be a kind of case just for appearances sake, it would go back.
Judges, I think, are often asked to disavow or cabin within their brains permissible factors from impermissible factors. And so even if a particular judge had initially considered an impermissible factor, if this court mandates that was an impermissible factor, I think a judge could be trusted to take that out of the box and take it out of consideration and give a
We do have categories of cases and sentences where we send it back to a new judge.
I understand.
Okay.
Right.
Okay. Well, thanks. Let me just ask you one other. I want to make sure I understand your position.
Mm-hmm.
To understand the government's position, when a Rule 35 motion is made, the way the trial judge should analyze the situation is to first determine what should be the extent of the departure, looking solely at substantial assistance. And then that sets the floor, so to speak. But the court can then make it a less departure based on factors unrelated to the assistance. But they can't go below, the court can't go below, give more credit, more time off.
That's right. And actually, this court has said that in the two unpublished decisions we said in our brief. In Lindsay, this is a quote, a sentencing court may not grant a substantial assistance departure or augment such a departure based on factors other than assistance.
Is that a published opinion?
It's unpublished, no. Woodward and Lindsay are both unpublished decisions.
Okay.
Unless the court has any additional questions, we would ask that you vacate the district court's judgment and remand this for resentencing.
All right. Thank you. Ms. Ginsburg?
May it please the court, my name is Nina Ginsburg. I represent Mr. Clausen. I recognize that the weight of authority is against me and Judge Shedd. I know that you were on the panel of those two opinions. I think I'm swimming uphill, but I would like to try and convince upstream. Thank you. But I'd like to try and convince Your Honors why those decisions are wrongly decided, and I think very seriously that they were wrongly decided. But first, it's some context to this case. this is not a case where at the last minute the judge misunderstood what was permitted to be considered in a Rule 35 hearing. At the original sentencing in this case, the judge was informed about the defendant's mental health, the medical conditions. He is diagnosed with extremely severe attention deficit hyperactivity disorder. He has been prescribed for more than 10 years with a Schedule II controlled substance, dexedrine, amphetamine, by a doctor at the Veterans Administration, another government doctor. And prior to the sentencing, the court was informed, I made inquiries of the Bureau of Prisons what they would do with respect to handling the medication issue, and received an email from someone at the Bureau of Prisons saying that he would not, he did not qualify to be treated with non-formulary medication, which means he would not get his medicine. This is the medication that has been effective for so many years. This individual was diagnosed with this disease at the age of 2 and has tried almost every drug in creation.
I don't think anyone questions the circumstances that we're confronting. And the question, of course, is whether or not factors unrelated to substantial assistance can be used to augment the departure.
I understand that.
And I appreciate your setting the context.
And the context is more than that, though. At the original sentencing, the judge announced that she knew there would be a Rule 35 and she could take this into account at the time. The prosecutor did not object to that at all. At the initial Rule 35 hearing, when the judge said, you know, my practice is to view these sentences anew, and I want an explanation from the Bureau of Prisons because I consider this significant.
But you think that's invited error or something?
Well, the prosecutor not only didn't object to her considering this additional factor.
But actually, in the wrong position on the law. I mean, what's the theory?
Well, Judge, I don't believe that the prosecutor actually thought it was the wrong theory of the law.
Ignorance of the law? I mean, what's your theory?
No. Let me put it another way. The judge did not, this was not a reopening of the initial sentencing. At the original sentencing, the judge was made aware of the...
But it was reopened as far as the sentence. Oh.
It reopened the sentence imposed, but not on the basis of a factor that the judge considered in her original sentence.
Is it particularly unusual for a defendant to ask for some kind of adjustment of the sentence based on health and medical treatment that the patient would receive as a defendant in the prison system? I found that not to be all that unusual. It happened frequently.
It does happen, but first, at least with respect to this case, the judge did not take that into consideration in her initial sentence in the 3553A factor.
She wasn't required to.
She wasn't required to, but she didn't have it before her. And had she had it before her at the time, she said, I don't have to worry about this now. I want more information. If she had it before her at the time, she might have imposed a sentence of 60 months as opposed to a sentence of 96 months.
Yeah, well, did defense counsel stand up to say, Your Honor, then I request a delay in sentence?
Well, no.
Get that information in front of you?
No one thought it was necessary because the prosecutor, everyone agreed that this...
Nobody knew the law then?
Well,
the law is, as the government says, nobody knew the law.
Well, that's only if the law is as the prior decisions have held.
Right.
And Your Honors, none of those cases have, in my view, effectively analyzed the plain language doctrine. And specifically, the two unpublished opinions on which Your Honor sat, they rely on cases that interpreted Rule 35 when it included, they say, when it included the specific language to reflect the amount of the substantial assistance.
If that language were in, would you lose? Do you think
yes,
you would?
Yes, absolutely.
You would
if that
lose.
Language were in, we would lose. But the language was removed.
What do you think of the advisory committee comments, whatever you call them, saying stylistic changes on it?
I take several positions on that. Sure. One, I think the law is fairly clear, and in fact, this case, this court in Hatch, I believe it was Hatcher or Carey, said that the advisory committee notes are not what the rule is. They may, in fact, the advisory committee notes may tell you what they think they're doing, but if the plain language says otherwise, even if it frustrates the intent, either the intent of the advisory committee or Congress's intent, it is the obligation of the court to enact that
information. What is the intent? What is the intent if, in fact, the title indicate it's for substantial assistance?
Not necessarily.
What does the title say?
And if it says reduction for substantial assistance.
For substantial assistance. It doesn't say motion for. Does it? Doesn't it say reduction for substantial assistance? Maybe I have that wrong. But
the rule itself, first of all, under the plain language doctrine, the court is not permitted to look at the title in order to understand
Well, actually, you may look at the title if it's not clear. If it's not clear, you may do it.
Well, Your Honor.
And the rule doesn't say you may consider other factors, does it?
No, but what the rule says, the rule is very clear. If we forget about all the context.
Let me ask you back to the rules, limit to the title. So if you use the title, what does the title say?
Well, the title says you can reduce a sentence for substantial
reducing
assistance.
Reducing a sentence for substantial assistance.
But that, Your Honor, that does not necessarily mean that defines what can be considered. It could just as easily mean that it entitles the court to consider a reduction if there is substantial assistance. And that is completely consistent with the language of Rule 35d1, which is upon the government's motion made within 1 year of sentencing, the court may. So upon the motion, the court may reduce the sentence if the defendant provided substantial assistance. It doesn't say.
So your reading of the Supreme Court cases that discuss the limited purpose of 35D and indicating that a defendant would have nothing to offer, unable to benefit from 35D, is simply saying that if you have something to offer, you get to have any other additional factors considered as well.
Judge Duncan, there is no Supreme Court case which addresses this issue. The Supreme Court case in Dillon addresses the question.
Well, actually, I was reading some language, and I was asking whether your view of that language is that the substantial assistance serves as a gatekeeping function only, and once you open that gate and go through it, then it's no longer a limit. Is that? I'm just trying to.
I understand. And what I'm saying is that is based on the plain reading of the text. That is as plausible an interpretation.
I wasn't arguing with you. I really wasn't. I was just asking you if that's your reading of the Supreme Court limiting language. That the limit comes at the outset, at the gatekeeping question.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. The answer to that question is yes.
Okay. And in fact, but as a follow-up, and my question then, and I'm wondering how you respond to it as a matter of concern, is what then incents the prosecution to file a 35C if it reopens anew the consideration of factors that go beyond substantial assistance? Or rather, and I'm really not trying to argue with you, but tell me, does that concern you? And if not, why not?
It doesn't, because before Rule 35B was, I think, 1984, before the language was added, prosecutors did file. Courts were permitted to consider everything, as the judge thought she was in this case. It didn't prevent the filing of Rule 35B motion. And in fact, I think that the prosecutors will use their discretion as they appropriately see fit. And based on the conduct of the prosecutor in this case, when the judge announced that she was going to consider 3553A factors, The prosecutor didn't say, no, judge, you're not allowed to. It didn't deter the prosecutor from filing this motion. And my view...
You said the practice was that before the rule was changed, that people considered, that the courts considered all kind of factors. Is that established as under case law, or is that by your knowledge of practice?
That is under case law, and that was why the rule was originally changed to include the language to reflect.
That's what I'm saying. I mean, but it was changed to reflect substantial assistance. Then during that time period, was it only, did it reflect other issues or only substantial assistance?
Before the rule was, before the
No, I'm talking about once it was changed to reflect substantial assistance.
I think
it was only for substantial assistance then, wasn't it?
Yes,
you know?
That's correct. And that's my understanding. And my understanding is not just Judge Brinkema, but in my experience in the Eastern District of Virginia, it varies by judges what they consider when once a Rule 35B motion has been filed. Judge Brinkema is not the only judge in the Alexandria Division who has considered factors other than the amount of the value of the substantial assistance in ruling on a 35B motion. Once the language was removed, and then once, especially after 2007, when the Booker,
Did they do that by your experience? Did they do that when the rule said to reflect? Did sometimes they also consider other factors?
Judge, that was in 2002. I can't honestly.
Because it strikes me that probably the language then didn't make much difference to the practice of what the court was doing one way or the other. Do you think? Or you just don't know?
Judge, I don't know. To be honest, I don't know. But what I think occurred in this case is that everybody, including the prosecutor, understood that the judge was permitted to consider these other factors, and it was not until the judge closed a sentence which the prosecutor felt was unduly lenient that this issue was raised. And in fact, the record reflects that. The prosecutor said he came into that hearing, didn't object to any of the judge's remarks about the Bureau of Prisons and the Eighth Amendment concerns that she raised, and at the end said, oh, excuse me, Judge, by the way, for the record, we think that you've exceeded your authority, and by the way, we have permission to appeal.
What you said that now a couple times. What legal significance is that, do you think? Is there some, you just named the context for us? Or do you think that carries some significance that the government, in your understanding, misunderstood what they now claim the law is? Are you suggesting we make something of that, or does it have some legal implication? I just don't know what that means, what you're doing.
I think it means two things.
Okay.
I think, one, it means that Your Honor's understanding of what the scope of the statute is may not be the law. That other...
Well, it is if we say it is.
If you say it is. If you say it is.
Well, I understand that.
But
you're up there arguing against it. You don't know what our view might be. You think their view is wrong. The government's view now is wrong.
Yes.
Okay, we got that.
But I also think that it perhaps is relevant. The government's position at throughout these proceedings is perhaps relevant to a question that Judge Duncan asked of what happens on remand. And the question of whether the remand should be just for a reconsideration of the Rule 35 motion, or it should be a remand of the entire sentence. And on that point, just before I forget, that the
on what basis would it be a remand for the entire sentence?
Well, in
I don't think I've heard that suggested before. Maybe I missed something.
Well, in the United, well, I think because of the position that the government took, the court did not feel the need to address certain 3553, certain factors, but the response of the Bureau of Prisons.
Wait one second. So do I understand that you are suggesting to us that because the government, you're suggesting the government took a different position in front of the court at the time of sentencing, that they, if they should win on the sentence, on the position they take now, that we should somehow in fairness or in equity allow there to be not just 35B considered, but the entire sentence reconsidered?
Yes.
Okay.
And I'm saying that for two reasons. One, because the prosecutor led the judge to believe that she need not consider all of those factors at the time of the sentencing. But also, and significantly, in the Supreme Court's very recent decision in Pepper versus United States, which I think is significant for several reasons, because it addresses the happenstance argument that is the basis for a number of the decisions on the Rule 35 question. Why should somebody who has the benefit of getting a reduction after the sentence be given a broader examination of factors than someone who gets them at the time of sentencing, because the language of 3553A-D says to reflect. The Supreme Court in Pepper said the fact you could consider post-sentencing, you could consider the broad range of factors, including post-sentencing rehabilitation. I think that answers the question that it's not just you can't decide this case based on happenstance, that you get a broader consideration because it happens later in the proceeding. But Pepper said, because a district court's original sentencing intent may be undermined by altering one portion of the calculus, an appellate court, when reviewing one part of a defendant's sentence, may vacate the entire sentence so that on remand, the trial court can reconfigure the sentencing plan to satisfy the sentencing factors in 3553A. So I think that is an answer to your question, Judge Shedd. But before I run out of time, there's a very important, I think the Sixth Circuit's en banc decision in Grant is very instructive. I don't agree with the ultimate result, but I think it's very instructive for the disposition of this case. And the en banc court found that the language was limited the language of Rule 35 was ambiguous, and therefore, because it was ambiguous, the court was permitted to look at the legislative history and the title of the statute. Had they found that the language was plain and unambiguous, they would not have. But they found, in their view, the language of Rule 35 B1 was ambiguous, and therefore they could look at the broader context. But significantly, they also held that in valuing a Rule 35 and in valuing the amount of the value of the substantial assistance, that the court could look at the context of the original sentencing and the context of the cooperation, and made a specific reference to the fact that some of those factors, the context factors, look very much like the Rule 3553A factors. And the concurring opinion concurred for that reason, that factors that in the wide discretion of the sentencing judge, the factors that can be considered in valuing the amount of the value and the circumstance of the substantial assistance can include things that are other than what we strictly consider these factors.
It's interesting to me that, and the government effectively concedes that to the extent that the district court did something wrong here, what they did was to specifically peg the departure to the concerns about medical care. The district court could have done, and I'm not sure how this was cut, but the district court could have done exactly what it did, and the government would have had no basis for challenge if it had simply done it without a specific attribution.
Well, I'm not sure that under the Sixth Circuit opinion that the manner in which a sentence is served is not something that could not be considered valuation of the cooperation.
I'm making a different point, Steve. My point is simply that the district court's error here, if error there was not in the reduction of the sentence or even the amount, but the specific attribution of the reason, making it clearer than daylight that it was because of this need for medical care.
And that's true. But I think that the judge didn't say anything about the value of the cooperation. We don't know if she didn't consider the value of the cooperation and consider this part of the context.
It didn't seem to be what she was.
It didn't sound like it.
Sure did.
It didn't sound like it.
It said too much. Rather than, it wasn't necessary to say anything.
Well,
It's not a challenge to you.
I understand, and I think
it's an interesting factor.
Yes. And I think in the overall analysis, though, that what the judge actually did do, at least in the Sixth Circuit en banc opinion, which was brought to the court's attention by the government.
Well, I guess it would still be error if she'd have done it for that motivation, if you accept the government's view. It'd just be that it wouldn't be an articulated justification for the error or an articulation of the error, and there'd be maybe no way to correct it, but it still might well be error.
Yes, but it might well not be. Under the Sixth Circuit...
Well, I know, but I'm saying under the government's
view. Yes, Your Honor, that's absolutely correct. But under the Sixth Circuit's opinion, and its articulation of what are permissible factors to consider, the factor that the Bureau of Prisons would make the defendant's service of his sentence so much more harsh than an ordinary person, it's like, it's in a way saying, if I was going to sentence you to 5 years and you're a normal person, you do 5 years. If I'm going to sentence you to, if you're Mr. Clausen, sentencing you to 3 days might be the equivalent of sentencing a normal person to 5 years. And that under the Sixth Circuit opinion, that
I'll guarantee you the person who got 5 years, you never convince that person of that.
I'm sure you wouldn't, but you don't, that person does not live in Mr. Clausen's shoes
either.
I'm going
to say, but there's no way you're going to convince anybody I've ever seen in the system that 5 years, for the person that gets 5 years is equal to 3 years, 3 days someone else gets. And we can make that argument, but in the real world, I don't think that's true. You may make an argument that he shouldn't serve 5 years. He should only serve 3 days.
But I agree with you, Your Honor. That person won't feel that way, but I think that how that person feels is totally irrelevant.
But I tell you, to the extent it is relevant, the comments you just made, I bet a lot of people are willing to stand up and say, Your Honor, I can tell you 3 days in jail will feel like five, so 3 is enough for me, too.
This is a man with a very...
I understand. I've sentenced lots and lots of people with medical conditions, and that's why I'm sure, that's why I asked you your experience, because my experience is I heard requests for reduced sentences based on medical conditions many, 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 many times. Well, it's not that unusual at all. You make some good legal points.
If I may, just very briefly, the formulary, the explanation from the Bureau of Prisons is that there's a non-formulary request process.
Did the defendant go to jail at all?
He went to jail for a day.
Yeah. Because during this original sentencing, it looked like the judge said, you're going to go to jail for a while, and then you'll get a 35B motion, it looks like, and then we'll decide how you've adjusted or something like that. Didn't she say that?
She did say
it
that.
Just like me, she anticipated he was going to go into custody. But he never did.
He never did.
Okay.
And he didn't because of the Bureau of Prisons' response, which is we will use our formulary medication, which is none of which.
So that response came in between the time she entered the sentence and before his reporting date?
Yes, that's correct. And because the Bureau of Prisons' formulary medication is not approved by the FDA for treatment of ADHD, and because two of the three formulary medications are medications that have been tried.
You've answered my question.
Thank you.
Thank
you, Your Honor.
Thank you. Reply, Ms. Goodham.
One point, unless the court has any additional questions, defense counsel suggested that the government was operating under misunderstanding about the scope of the proceeding. And at pages 157 to 158 of the joint appendix, suggestion is belied. Many years of reviewing transcripts have not encountered a more clear articulation of exactly the wrong that the district court did here.
But the suggestion is that came late in the game. That's the suggestion.
Your Honor,
you heard it too. I looked back through and I found that, but I was quickly looking through the earlier part, the sentencing, the original sentencing, to see if somehow the government had acquiesced or anything. I couldn't find it just on quick review, but.
I don't think the record shows that, and if you look at the government's Rule 35 motion, of course, that only makes reference to assistance factors.
But the question is, the record may reflect this, if the government thought that the judge planned to use the health issues in the 35B motion when she talked about that at the time of original sentence.
My reading of the record is not that. My reading of the record is that the parties were going to endeavor to work with the Bureau of Prisons in the interstitial period between the sentencing and the Rule 35 hearing as best they could to account for the defendant's needs. And I think the government prosecutor's actions show that he did endeavor to work with the defendant and BOP as best he could.
You say you don't think the record reflects that the government thought that the judge was going to take those health concerns into account at 35B time and acquiesced it.
No. No. Thank you, Your Honor.
Okay.